Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. My name is Sarah Bramau Ramos, and I am one of the hosts on the channel. And I am joined today by Nathan Vidal to talk about his new book, The Culture of Language in Ming China, Sound, Script, and the Redefinition of Boundaries of Knowledge. Welcome to New Books, Nathan, and thank you so very much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Sarah, for having me. I'm really excited to have this chance to talk about the book with you.
Of course. So why don't we start, as is traditional, with, before we get to the book, with you. So how did you come to work on Chinese history and specifically the history of the Ming Dynasty?
Right. I guess I took a bit of a circuitous route into Chinese history and maybe academia in general. I had done my undergraduate training in music at a music conservatory. I played double bass. And my life up until that point had primarily been devoted to practicing and preparing for a career in performance. But I had started studying the Chinese language in high school. And was fortunately able to continue studying through college through a reciprocal arrangement between the conservatory and another university. And when I had finished my time at the conservatory, I was sort of at this crossroads where I could continue along the path of music performance or try something else. And I'd been captivated by initially the study of the language and then moving from that to literature and history that I felt compelled to at least pursue Chinese studies a while longer. So I entered graduate school first and master's program and then PhD. And I guess the road toward Ming for me stemmed out of what had been a longstanding interest in the history of language study. And there's a much longer story of how I'd kind of come across the texts that I look at in the book that are, you know, Ming linguistic writings that had largely been neglected. But after I had come across this set of books, I immediately fell in love with them because, well, frankly, I couldn't really make heads or tails of what was going on inside of them. They seem clearly to be primarily invested in linguistic questions, describing, categorizing, cataloging things about language. And yet they did so by talking about all of these other things I would tend to think have nothing at all to do with language, like music, mathematics, cosmology. And so this is what really drew me first of all, to these kind of texts, and really to the Ming in general, which is, I think, a period, a really ecumenical period in which we see all of these interesting intersections of literature, but also classical studies in ways that tend to be less, well, I don't want to say, you know, interesting in another period, but certainly the kinds of wild argumentation that are really captivating, something I think unique in this period, and drew me toward it initially.
Fascinating. I have to admit, when I was reading, especially the middle chapters of this book, the question that I was initially thinking of asking was, how did a historian feel about, you know, working with music? And now I realize that I should have flipped that question. Given your origin, given your sort of trajectory, if you like, into this work. But thank you for setting that up. So language, literature, history, music, all of which really, I suppose, comes through in the book itself. So, you know, with that, why don't we dive into it? So your book is, as the title suggests, really about language. You know, you begin the introduction with this key question, what is the nature of language? And the book then looks at how scholars in the Ming studied language and how their practices reflect broader intellectual trends and literary trends, because as you just sort of hinted at, the study of language, philology, was bound up in the Ming with subjects beyond the strictly linguistics. And overall, then, the book unravels the logic underlying the interconnectedness of knowledge and its implications for our understanding of late imperial Chinese scholarly practice, to quote from the introduction. So much of this book focuses on philology, and you show that it was a really, as you just said, vibrant, interesting, complicatedly interconnected field, which were all things about it that were then criticized in later periods. So could you explain this a little bit? So how did, you know, Qing scholars in particular, looking backwards in time, think about Ming scholarship, and how did this then shape and really, you know, define how scholars since the Qing have approached Ming intellectual history?
Well, I think you've really hit it at the core here of you know, in the book, I make reference to more recent historiography about, you know, late imperial Chinese intellectual history. But I think a lot of that really traces back, in fact, just as you say, to the Qing dynasty in the 18th century, when scholars begin looking back at some of these earlier practices in the 16th and 17th centuries, and largely, in my view, writing them out of the history of scholarship or of valid intellectual activity. And they have very prominent venues, first of all, in which they can do that, particularly, and perhaps most famously, the Siku Quan Shu project in the late 18th century, commissioned by the emperor to collect, compile all of the texts in the realm. And there is, first of all, the Siku Quan Shu proper, which is a collection of books, and very, very few Ming linguistic texts are included there. So first of all, this very prominent collection excludes much of this earlier tradition. There is, however, a bibliographical catalog that accompanies the collection that is much more inclusive insofar as it includes the titles of many of these Ming texts and a brief evaluation in which the Qing editors essentially systematically criticize all of the elements they see as so misguided about these Ming scholars that they, precisely the fact that they didn't keep strictly to one historical time frame, for instance, which for the Qing scholars was primarily we should look at antiquity and base our understanding of antiquity through the study or corroboration of other texts from antiquity. The fact that the Ming scholars were going at kind of across time was an issue. The fact that they pulled on all these other apparently non-linguistic fields was another major issue for the Qing scholars, who argued that this was not really true philology and therefore could be ignored. And this attitude was, I mean, they were really quite successful, I think, in writing out these texts because they didn't really factor into most of the later retellings of late imperial intellectual history that have, for the most part, taken for granted their telling of the story, which is that they created this field of learning in the 18th century, with the exception of a few kind of handpicked predecessors in earlier periods, including they acknowledged there were a couple of good guys in the Ming as well, but really kind of misrepresenting what was actually going on in this earlier period. And that's kind of the premise of my book, is that scholars in the Ming in the 16th and the 17th century didn't think that they were bad scholars. You know, they weren't waiting for people in the 18th century to come save them and save the history of linguistics, but instead that they developed these particular methodologies for studying language based on a set of epistemological assumptions about the nature of correct or valid knowledge.
Mm-hmm. As you were just saying, you know, you, this is the premise of the book, and your approach then is to really look at these earlier Ming scholars and take them, you know, how would I put it, at face value, or at least to follow their logic where their logic leads, right? As you said, they're not waiting for the 18th century for someone to make sense of them. They know what they're doing. It's just, you know, they know what they're doing. It makes sense to them. And this really ties in then with something I really appreciated about your book, was the way in which you approach intellectual change, intellectual thought, and ideas, not in terms of present day categories, but in terms of historical ones. And this is something that you raise several times, you know, quite explicitly in the book, particularly when you're pointing out, you know, possibilities of present day comparisons or comparisons across the early modern world, that, you know, these are some similarities, but but I'm going to look at these Ming scholars based on historical actors categories. So I'm hoping you might say a little bit about this. Why was this approach important to you, and how did it, you know, shape the work of, you know, putting the book together, of the book that exists as it does today?
That's a good question. I think it became essential for this project because I wanted to understand how people study language. And in fact, there are some really useful tools to do that, but you have to kind of relinquish, you know, the assumptions we have about what these texts, what might constitute language or the study of language, for instance. And this goes back to this point about them not being, not thinking that they were bad scholars. They seemed like bad scholars to the Qing, you know, scholars. And then today, I mean, I'm not saying that I think that they were actually good necessarily from our perspective today of what constitutes valid linguistic observation. But in order to do the best I could to remove, you know, my biases about what linguistic study looks like, of course, what the 18th century Qing scholars, what they thought, I resorted to what I see is the best indicators of these kind of contemporary categories. So those would be, for instance, bibliographical catalogs, which include sections that are variously labeled, but indicate that they're content is linguistic in nature. So one of the most useful categories is that of xiaoxue, literally the lesser learning, but generally is used to refer to three main areas of linguistic study: the study of linguistic sound, study of script, and study of the meaning of words. And these contemporary terms, which were often used then to categorize the text I was looking at, served as my guide to what thinkers of the time actually believed that they were working on, even if it didn't necessarily appear that way from a present day perspective.
Perfect. Thank you for setting that up. And on that topic of, you know, what they actually believed they were working on, let's dive into, I think you might be able to tell where I'm going with this. Let's dive into chapter one. So chapter one is part of part one, and part one really sets, you know, sets the scene for the rest of the book that follows, in that it establishes, you know, the communities of learning, the religious, philosophical, and cosmological communities of learning in the world of philology in the Ming. But chapter one might be, you know, the most important of all three, in that it unpacks the epistemological underpinnings of Ming philology, which revolves around self-so knowledge. So what is self-so knowledge, and how did it shape and change the way that Ming literati did their philological work?
Right. So I think, first of all, you're absolutely right. You know, if anyone were to read one chapter of the book, it probably should be the first, which I think much of the argument in later chapters is really comes out of some of what is established in that first chapter. And in particular, as you say, this issue of self-so knowledge, the term 自然, meaning something that is so of itself. It can be understood, I think, also in comparison or in contrast to what it is not. The typical juxtaposition we see in these texts is that which is self-so, 自然, versus that which is man-made, 人为. So things that are man-made are characterized by artifice and constrained by the limited potential of observation that any individual has. What is self-so, by contrast, is something that is validated not by the observation or perception of an individual, but rather the coherence that underlies all things in the universe. So this, of course, harkens back to a very important, we can say for shorthand, Neo-Confucian idea of Li, or a coherence that fundamentally ties together, that is unitary, shared among all things, despite their different manifestations. And the significance of this universality for Ming thinkers was that there are a lot of linguistic issues that we don't know the answer to. We don't know what is the best categorization system, or to decide how many rhymes exist, or how many syllable initials. All of these are kind of open questions. In order to solve these unknowns, if we posit that in fact these kind of categories belong to some much grander universal scheme, then perhaps we can reach out into other related fields of knowledge. And based on the knowns from those fields, we can begin to solve for the unknowns in language. So the kind of paradigmatic example would be the relationship that's established between music and language. Music being a field that, first of all, had deep cosmological roots in antiquity, and was long held to have a kind of inviolable basis in mathematics or arithmetic calculations. So we can understand the number of pitches in the musical scale that is produced by this infallible arithmetic calculation. So there are 12 pitches. This must be a kind of sonic category or number, right? 12, that is based in these universal truths. We know that from music, it has been established and proven. Let's establish that, or let's apply that rather to another arena that involves sound, that of linguistic sound. And so we see in this period then this explosion of experimentation with 12-part categorizations of syllables or this kind of thing, but based on a calculation that's fundamentally rooted in this idea that there are universal truths, and we can deduce those, for instance, through mathematical calculation in some contexts, and then use those to apply to language.
Mm-hmm. When you were talking before about, looking beyond your own bias and the biases of the Qing scholars, I was reminded of the way that you talk about in this chapter that Ming scholars are trying to use this idea of self-so knowledge to surpass the limits of human perception and bias, right? Just thinking about how that ties back to your earlier point that you made about, you're not trying to claim that they were doing work that is of the kind we would recognize today, but there's certainly some, they're not, how would I put it? What they're trying to get at is maybe recognizable, right? And the idea that I'm trying to look beyond the limits of human perception or bias itself.
That's exactly right. And then at the end of that first chapter, I try to juxtapose this idea of self-so knowledge with the later Western conception of objective knowledge, which at least at a discursive level, there is this similarity of objectivity as often being mechanized, of going beyond human observation. So as you say, very recognizable in that sense. And in fact, these Ming scholars were aware of ways of studying language that resembled the methods that the later Qing scholars would use. But the mainstream Ming thinkers generally criticized those methods as faulty precisely because of their reliance on either textual records that they felt were inadequate, that we don't have that much text left from antiquity, which is also, you know, a reasonable claim, as well as the idea that, you know, observation or, you know, our, my personal preference for, you know, this dialect is going to motivate my construction of a linguistic categorization system. And so just as you say, that the one of the primary arguments here is that we want to surpass these kind of biases to create a truly kind of comprehensive linguistic system that is not something that could be criticized as being the product of the limits. One thing, you know, that comes up again and again is that humans can only hear certain sounds. And once someone is no longer an infant, their speech becomes constrained by what they hear around them. So they also can't utter certain sounds. And these were all seen as kind of limiting factors that cosmological methods that relied on this idea of there being an alternative, that which is self-so, could surpass.
I was reminded when you were describing, you know, from infancy of, I think there's a line here, something about babies crying in multiple parts as well, or something about from infancy. I was just reminded of that, which struck me as like, huh, yes, they do.
Yes. Well, there's this, there's a constant refrain among many different thinkers from this period about how, you know, all infants, you know, at birth make the same cry. Mm-hmm. And it's only over time that we start to see these kind of differentiations in region, for instance, which I think, if anyone has spent enough time in the pediatrician's office, it can be difficult to separate among, and indeed even for people who study the sort of the physiology of you know, how humans develop speech. It is, we all know that young people, right, they can very quickly learn to speak a language fluently with flawless pronunciation, and that ability decreases as we get older. So again, this is a kind of observation that is rooted in things that we believe to be true today as well. But then the way that they try and get around these issues is of course quite different.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of things that Ming scholars knew about and things that they knew of, this moves us, you know, one of the things that they were aware of was different language systems, different scripts, and in particular, phonological scripts, which is something that you look at then in chapters 2 and 3, which make up part 1 of the book. So these chapters, and I'm just going to briefly sort of touch on some of the core ideas and things that these chapters talk about. So one of the main things that these Ming scholars are dealing with, though, is phonological scripts and the way that they transcribe sounds that do not exist in Chinese. And here you look in particular at Sanskrit, although Latin appears as well. So chapter 2 mainly looks at that. Chapter 3 looks at how the debate over phonographic writing played out in terms of how thinkers are thinking about Chinese writing. So something that led to new proposals about how to index and retrieve information. And in both of these chapters, again, thinking of, you know, things that Ming scholars were aware of, you make the point that this idea that a phonographic script is superior to logographic writing, this was not something that Ming scholars thought. That was not something that was evident to them in the way that later language reformers might make the case that this is true. This was definitely not the case for Ming scholars. But you also note that thinkers did disagree in this period about what the source of the superiority of Chinese graphs actually was. So you look at a number of different thinkers here. But could you touch on maybe a few of the ideas that were being bandied about as to what made, to Ming scholars, Chinese graphs so superior? What were sort of the strengths that they saw in Chinese?
Yeah, it's a good point. I think you bring in our awareness of later reformers, because certainly what initially I was seeing this very surprising, I think based on our understanding of the history of language study in China, a very surprising attention to phonographic writing systems already in this period. One of the questions that's always going to come up is, well, you know, was there any idea that in fact that could replace Chinese characters? As far as I've seen, with one or two exceptions, the idea never really comes up. There is a sense that phonographic writing systems are very useful within the context of theoretical phonology. Just as you say, if we want to represent all possible sounds, and if we can't do that solely with Chinese characters, these kind of phonographic writing systems can be used to supplement Chinese writing in that context. But they're not really seen as something that's going to be useful for everyday writing in this way that, for instance, you know, later reformers, of course, will say, oh, this is the road toward mass literacy, is to have, you know, phonetic writing. There are many reasons why Chinese characters are still held to be the superior writing system. I think perhaps the most interesting criticisms of phonographic writing would be, for instance, the idea that in fact it's more confusing than the Chinese character, which, you know, we know there are a set of rules that apply to every Chinese character, that it contains the sound of, you know, one syllable. It has, you know, one, of course, it can have more than one, but also, you know, there's sort of one fundamental semantic sense to each character. So it's kind of this compact unit of sound and meaning. Whereas phonographic writing, particularly to readers who are not as familiar with it, seems quite baffling. The idea that, especially given that phonographic writing was largely evident in these very kind of abstract theoretical texts on language, so it was associated more with these kind of almost phonographic calculations, in which you would look at something written down phonetically, and then go through a rather arduous process of putting together those sounds in your mind to figure out what the, you know, just how the word would be read out loud. And then an additional process of associating that sound that you just uttered with a word. And so it seemed much less efficient than Chinese writing. The other, I think, interesting argument that comes up at some point in the book is one thinker who actually says, you know what, I will grant that the phonographic writing is simpler. It is, in fact, you know, easier to learn than Chinese. But that's precisely the point. That's why Chinese is superior, at least for Chinese civilization. We are so rich that only Chinese characters could possibly fully characterize or encompass everything that we have. And it is only those that are culturally impoverished that could rely on such, you know, a writing system that doesn't have this kind of greater significance.
I love there's a line in here somewhere, which is, you know, one might recognize the sound, but not the meaning. Thinking of phonographic scripts. There's much in these chapters, and, you know, lots of different thinkers, lots of different ideas, as you just sort of highlighted a few. There's, as I indicated, or as you sort of summarized, you know, definitely read chapter one, do not skip chapters two and three, and definitely don't skip part two, which is where I'm going to move us, which I will play my cards. I enjoyed very, very much. So part two of the book looks at the interaction of literature and textual philology. So chapter 4 looks at opera specifically. And this is a really fascinating chapter, at least it was to me, as you look here at pronunciation debates and debates about regional difference. And, you know, and you show how, you know, these debates over regional difference and how or whether to standardize the language really brought classicists and philologists into dialogue with opera librettists. So people who were concerned with establishing a fundamental unified pronunciation for recitation and singing. And you point out that in this chapter, this fascination with pronunciation has sometimes been characterized as sort of, you know, a kind of elite strategy, a sort of a form of connoisseurship. But you suggest that operatic language debates were not solely intended for the eyes of fellow librettists. So much of this chapter is about the cross-fertilization between operatic and classical philology. And again, as with previous chapters, you talk about a number of different writers. Is there maybe one you could introduce us to, someone who, you know, combines the operatic and philological sort of worlds together, someone who does that cross-fertilization sort of work?
Definitely. I think probably the best example would be this opera theorist named Shen Chongsui. Shen Chongsui writes a manual that is it's titled Du Qi Xu Zhi. So basically things you need to know to write opera. Du Qi could also mean to sing opera as well. But the title of this book, when you see it, you would think, of course, this is only relevant for people very much in the opera trade, right? This is a pedagogical text, and it is a pedagogical text for librettists to consult. And also it's clearly directed at the training of singers, that they learn the proper methods of pronunciation. This is a big concern in this period as we have these kind of expanding literary markets, but at the same time, regional forms of drama. How can we have these operatic performances rendered in such a way that audiences in different regions can still understand what's being sung? So on the one hand, this manual walks through, you know, the methods of training singers, gives very practical tips about enunciation. But it also is deeply invested with these thorny cosmological, philological issues that characterize some of the most abstract theoretical work among classical scholars of language. And not only does it cite some of those texts, so clearly we this is not a guess, we know that Shen Chongsui was reading those books and taking inspiration from them. He also was innovating new techniques of representing sound. Most famously, he created a new way of dividing up the Chinese syllable into three parts rather than two, which had been the primary way of talking about linguistic sound prior to this text. And he also hints at the fact that this book could be useful for these scholars outside of operatic circles. He says that, you know, people will be able to recite the classics better, for instance, when they adopt his method of describing pronunciation. But for me, I think the most enjoyable or most, you know, kind of striking thing was to see that, in fact, we can see very clearly that classical philologists were reading this opera pronunciation guidebook, and quite a number of them would cite him explicitly. There were debates about, oh, well, is this only appropriate for opera? And the conclusion generally was like, no. In fact, these are universal principles about language that he's discussing. And in fact, the cosmological phonologist whose earlier work had been cited in this handbook, in a much later work he writes when he's, you know, an older scholar, he cites the opera handbook. So there's this constant sort of interchange between these two fields that is very clearly displayed in the citations among these works, and is very surprising because we tend the opera, of course, is one of the most famous things when we talk about, you know, I was mentioning at the very beginning, you know, why am I and why are many people attracted to the Ming Dynasty is because of this kind of literary splendor of some of the great operas, for instance, in the late Ming. And we tend to think of that as so separate from the kind of boring world of classical philology that will take, you know, hold later on in Chinese history. But what we see in the Ming is, in fact, these things could really go hand in hand and in a collaborative way that is one of the ways in which we can, I think, understand the difference in what's going on in this period compared to later periods.
Also something that is very important for, you know, the boring world of officialdom as well. I mean, you touch on here, I think it's a different writer, but you talk about a different writer sort of saying that, you know, traveling officials ought to also work on their pronunciation, and, you know, these kinds of guides might also be useful for them.
Yeah, exactly.
in working to standardize their accents.
Yeah, that's right. And that particular case is actually Li Yu, who is one of the most, you know, well-known literary figures of this period, but always as a representative of that kind of extreme of sort of literary indulgence in the late Ming and early Qing. When in fact, he's also apparently well-versed in these, you know, classical philological studies, and proposes just what you've highlighted here, this you know, really wild idea that, you know, opera, he says, I think something like opera is, you know, could be the universal language because it's this area in which we pay so much attention to pronunciation. It could be very useful in other contexts where people need to learn to, refine their pronunciation, such as the traveling officials who are going all over China. If they paid more attention to what we're doing here in the opera community, maybe, you know, there wouldn't be these kind of miscommunications based on, you know, unintelligible local dialects.
Mm-hmm. On the, speaking of, you know, the places in which philology is found or brought into and the different uses that it's put to, that sort of, you know, the plurality of interest that really carries over into chapter 5, which looks at something I think touched on a few times now, but the intersection of classical and literary learning, and specifically how literary modes of reading were applied to classical works. So here you look in particular at how the dominant Qing approach, which we might summarize as the six classics are all history, you have in the Ming instead a different approach. The six classics are all rhyming texts. So very different way of thinking of the classics. And you also, I'll just note, you also explore here how Ming scholars tried to reconstruct the melodies of antiquity, which predated the invention of musical notation, on the premise that there's a connection between musical and linguistic sound. So, and I will just note that part of the chapter is fascinating, and there are notes, and there are some examples, but I'll park that for now. What I wanted to ask about is about this approach to the classics. And I'm really curious actually as to how this Ming approach and thinking of the classics as being rhyming texts and literary texts, how it actually shapes how, you know, you think of the classics or how you might teach the classics. Are there sort of thinking both about this chapter and maybe places in which this chapter might move to in terms of its being used? Has this changed the way that you think or teach the classics at all?
Yeah, that's a really good question. First, before parking that earlier issue about the notes in the musical notes in the chapter, I would highly suggest if anyone has a keyboard in this chapter in front of them, to try and play them, because it's amusing to see this process of these what sound like, you know, melodies, and then the progression to these pretty horrendous, you know, just don't seem to have any kind of tonal center melodies that, but that were based on these calculations that are in turn are, you know, rooted in the idea that, as you said, the musical and linguistic sound must be related.
I have not tried it, but now I know exactly what I'm going to be doing after we finish this.
It's well worth it to just to,
okay.
to imagine. Wait, was this person serious that this was probably the melody for this ancient poetry? This, you know, what sounds like a kind of a 12-tone, free for all. So, but back to your question about has this changed how I think about or teach the classics? I think that it could. If in general, I think this project has pushed me to think beyond disciplinary boundaries that govern the departments we belong to in universities, to a certain extent, are the conferences we attend, the societies, the academic societies that are organized by, and that in some ways, force the directions in which we do research as well as teach. And I think working on this book really pushed me to reevaluate, my assumptions about what things go together and how to approach, as you say, texts like the classics. I think there could be a very valuable way of teaching these books based on their literary merit or how might we understand, the literary narrative of the Analects, which, I'm sure my colleagues in early China might be very angry to based on their deep knowledge of how the text was actually constructed. But for most of its history, it existed in a form, in a book that people might read in different ways. And I think getting students to approach these texts, not necessarily exclusively for their sort of important and potentially, universal ideas that they contain, but also to think about what kind of, enjoyment we can derive from them on an aesthetic level, I think can only be, an additional kind of value to explore these texts, both personally and on the teaching level.
Absolutely. And it is, as I said, I will definitely be finding some way to play the musical notes after this, but it really is the earlier part of the chapter as well, really is a really interesting rethinking, or at least it was for me, way of rethinking and thinking anew about texts that I've read before in a very different way. But thinking about disciplinary boundaries. Part three of your book is really all about disciplinary boundaries. And this really looks at the afterlives of Ming texts and methodologies. So chapter six, appropriately named Afterlives, really details how later Qing scholars didn't really think much of the cosmological and literary modes of philological study that we've been talking about. But it also shows that despite their, dismissal, Ming methods did survive in the Qing, and that some texts from the Ming did continue to be, reprinted in new editions in this later period. So in this chapter, there's a number of texts and figures that come up earlier in the book that make a return, just in new forms or in interesting places. So I'm curious, when you were doing the research for this chapter, was there a later use or reprint that you found particularly surprising? Something that you really wouldn't have expected later Qing scholars to have found useful at all that they, seem to have?
Yeah, I think one example that comes to mind would be essentially a dictionary or rhyme dictionary. called Wufang Yuanyin. Yuanyin means something like the originary or primordial sounds, and then the Wufang, so the five directions. So the idea of Yuanyin was one of the sort of primary motivators of Ming philological thinkers, was that they were going to, again, get past human bias and reconstruct sort of the original sounds before they were corrupted by humans. So the title of this work itself is very clearly rooted in that tradition. And then if you open it up in the sort of first editions of the text, which is actually an early Qing text, I should say, when I say Ming also is often as kind of a shorthand, the methods that extend a few decades past the end of the Ming state. But when you open up this text, and it sure enough, it goes into considerable detail about these cosmological underpinnings of the text in self-sought knowledge, and includes all these kind of cool cosmological diagrams, for instance, that are very common in Ming philological text. But it turns out that this was a really popular book throughout the Qing dynasty as well, which I found pretty surprising given the general denigration of that method of study in the period. And so I went about looking at then some of these later editions and how do they handle with, or how do they handle or deal with this cosmological inheritance. This particular example is more of a crude approach in which they basically just chop it all out. Although they don't change the title of the book, which is already, invokes this kind of cosmology, that kind of cosmological framework that accompanies much of the kind of paratextual material at the beginning of the book, in many of the later editions, is largely excised. So that's one way of doing it. But then they kind of go one step further in the later editions, really kind of in defiance of the original intention of the book, say, this is a dictionary of official court, pronunciation. So they really kind of rub it in the face of, they think their original version, which is say, not only are we going to remove, but we're going to reframe it as a book that's useful for understanding a very specific style of pronunciation. So that to me was very one striking example. We see other interesting uses of these earlier texts too, in which they seem to think that there's valuable information compiled, as long as it can kind of be extracted and the husk of this kind of earlier methodology left to rot in the past.
I think in some ways that's a great illustration of how different the Qing period is from, for at least, the 18th and 19th centuries are from the earlier period, as you were talking about it and describing it before as being, a melding of different disciplines and whatnot. Here, it's a little bit, or it's much more rigid. Only the husk sort of remains. The husk can stay, everything else can go. This then, thinking about what stays and what remains and what doesn't, this sort of is all, wrapped up for the moment, at least, in Chapter 7, which looks at sort of the afterlife of philological communities and disciplinary boundaries of the Ming, as we've just sort of been touching on a little bit. So you note that 18th and 19th century scholars formed similar networks of scholarship, and they too valued philology, but they reframed the boundaries of philology. They narrowed it down. They focused exclusively on the language of ancient texts and husks of others. And so much of this chapter really does focus on this new kind of disciplinary specialization in the Qing. And one thing I want to highlight about this chapter is your exploration of the growth of a historical narrative for the origins of philology, and how this redefinition came to highlight particular figures, particular individuals whose methods, were approved of in the Qing at the expense of others. This idea of, recovering the histories of texts of some of the people that, Qing scholars left out, that's really something that is, carried through all the different chapters of your book. So, before we wrap up our conversation fully, are there any last, seemingly obscure texts or obscure figures that you want to highlight here? either someone who's made it in the book or maybe someone who didn't make it in the book. Is there anyone you want to sort of mention here that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet in the spirit of highlighting of the you know, quote the single quotation marks, unworthy scholars.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, I might think of two people actually. Well, one of whom is actually not unknown, but I hope that his appearance in the book could, his work outside of just the fields I discuss in the book could stand for a much broader kind of reevaluation, and that is Fang Yizhi. So Fang Yizhi has long been understood as a pivotal intellectual in the mid 17th century, usually though in this sense of foreshadowing what was to come in the Qing dynasty. And what I tried to do in the book was to situate him and make him actually much less pivotal in some sense and more representative of the kind of philological activity that was occurring at the time, that he was deeply concerned with cosmological methods and thought that those were the key to kind of unlocking the comprehensive description of linguistic sound. And so by situating this figure as a kind of representative of broader trends at his time, I think there could be much more to be said there about this moment in the mid 17th century that is sometimes mined as the turning point. But you know, if it's not the turning point, then what exactly is going on there? Another thinker who didn't make it into the discussion today, or really into the book, he might be buried in a footnote somewhere, but didn't really get. I think the attention that he was due, is Dong Yue, who is. Well, his name goes by a number of pronunciations, but this is the pronunciation I'll stick with, Dong Yue. Most famously, he's associated with Xiu Bu, a sequel to the Journey to the West. And he actually wrote very extensively on philology in this period, mid-17th century. The texts are not well known, and in part because, in contrast, actually, a lot of the texts that I focus on in this book, they're not as widely accessible. These were, I found them while doing archival work in Japan, and filled up, you know, a notebook, you know, transcribing by hand these interesting texts, and hopefully I'll be able to return to them someday. But he really, I think, plumbs kind of the extremes of correlating I Ching cosmology and language. And I think it'd be really interesting to think as well about how this might relate to some of his better known literary pursuits. Although the authorship of Xiu Bu is a little bit in dispute, I add as a little qualification there. But anyway, so those are my picks, Fang Yizhi and Dong Yue.
I have to admit, I did not notice Dong Yue in the book. I will have to go hunting in the footnotes for him.
He can be glad that he has at least one. His name is being raised here.
So with this, we do come to the end of your book, but there is an epilogue. We come to the end of the body chapters, I suppose, but the epilogue. So the epilogue does touch on some of the later, you know, more recent resonances, particularly on and around language reforms and modern Chinese language reforms specifically. And as listeners of this channel might know, this is something that has attracted quite a bit of interest recently, as there are some new books on the topic. So this epilogue does go through a few, you know, a number of ideas and people from the Ming that were referenced later. And you end the book itself with this line: "As esoteric as their writings appear, the concerns of Ming philologists continue to resurface within China's linguistic practices today." So there's a lot that this epilogue covers, but is there, you know, one particular takeaway from the Ming case that you want to leave listeners with, particularly listeners who might be especially interested in language reform?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the bigger takeaways would be an issue that actually came up earlier in our conversation, but just to sort of reframe it in this context is, you know, what does it mean to engage with phonographic writing in China? And I've laid out what I see. Here is, you know, one way we might contrast the interest in phonographic writing in the Ming in contrast to the Reform period, which is, broadly speaking, in the Reform period, a goal of mass literacy versus in the Ming, one of, you know, theoretical abstraction of linguistic sounds. But I think there's probably room for you know, more nuanced studies of this relationship. If we look at what's transpiring in the early 20th century in China, late 19th century through the first half of the 20th century and beyond, as of course rooted in things that are very specific to the modern context, but also clearly born out of a much longer trajectory, I think there's a lot of room for new stories to tell about how this kind of reform either really was a revolution from, or to what degree was it actually also pulling on some of these earlier trends. As I talked about in the epilogue, in some ways there were very kind of self-conscious overtures to these earlier periods in ways that were sometimes, you know, self-serving. But in any case, I think, you know, I hope that there can be a productive dialogue with people who work in this more modern area, because I sort of touch on it very briefly in this epilogue, and I think there's probably much more to be done.
Oh, I think definitely in terms of much more to be done, but also the fact that you definitely touch on it. I mean, there's a number of different sort of strands that you lay out in terms of different people who reference earlier thinkers or different time, you know, there's a lot in the epilogue. So, you know, definitely hit chapter one, the middle section, but do not skip the epilogue.
Yep.
But with this, we come to the end of your book, you know, in its entirety, and the end of our conversation as a whole. But I hope that we, you know, had a chance to scratch the surface of some of what's in your book. There is so very much in it in terms of ideas and thinkers and texts. It is so very rich. But now that you are done with this project, now that the book is out there, what are you working on now, Nathan? What is inspiring you at the moment?
Thanks. Yeah, it's a great moment, you know, to be when you're done with the book, and it's a long process. And so I've been going in a few different directions. The area that's captured my interest as of late, and it's one that, of course, speaking with you is one of really the, you know, I think true up and coming scholars in this area, and I have much to learn from you in this area, this field. But it's this burgeoning, I think, field of study, which is Manchu, we could say, literary culture. I approach more given my background from the kind of intellectual history perspective. So I'm looking at how Manchu writings integrated with Chinese intellectual and literary traditions, and how this might contribute to our understanding of both ideas of Manchu identity and also Qing, you know, intellectual culture more broadly, as well as, of course, the kind of Manchu study specific questions of what were the spheres of Manchu influence outside of the better known administrative or bureaucratic ones.
We were talking about bias before. So with the, you know, full, all of my own bias here, that sounds fascinating. I mean that genuinely, but I will acknowledge that you are talking to the converted here, but
I'll take it.
I very much look forward to reading and hearing and listening to more about that as you go forward. But thank you again for taking the time to talk to me about this. This book and this work in particular.
Thank you very much for having this conversation with me. It was really a pleasure.